Hi, folks. Well, thanks for coming, and good to see you all. Thank you for the welcome. It's been great these last few days here on the campus and finding out about Regent College. Great stuff. The title of my session is Hidden Creeds, Sacred Themes in Popular Culture. And what we're going to be thinking about is the nature of the sacred in contemporary culture. What does it mean in the 21st century? And what does it look like? How does it manifest itself? I'm going to suggest that we find it in all kinds of forms that we normally wouldn't associate with religion and the sacred, and hence my title. It's hidden, a lot of this stuff, until we start scraping away and looking for it. And to try and prove my point, I'll be taking you to a couple of places today. First, we're going to go to Atlanta, Georgia. That was kind of mentioned earlier on, to one of the city's biggest tourist attractions. And later, we're going to go to London to a hushed and hallowed hall where an art exhibition is taking place. And finally, we'll be thinking about what some of the implications of all of this are for theology, for art, and for Christian living as well. In 1990, this guy, Salman Rushdie, wrote an essay. He just published a novel called The Satanic Verses, which many of you will know about. Maybe some of you have even read. And there was a huge controversy about it. And in this essay, Rushdie reflected on the meaning of the sacred in late 20th century society. 1990, remember. So it's 20 years ago now. Getting on. But the kind of stuff that he addresses in this his essay, still important, I think. It was meant to be delivered by Rushdie at a public gathering in London, and it was a well-known lecture series called the Herbert Read Memorial Lecture. But because of the controversy surrounding the novel and the fact that Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran had issued a fatwa against him, there was a serious threat on his life. Basically, some people, some Muslims, felt that it was their responsibility to kill him for his blasphemy. So instead of him delivering the lecture, he can appear in public, and it was read out by his friend, the playwright Harold Pinter. And the title of this lecture was, Is Nothing Sacred? Is Nothing Sacred? That was the central question of what was actually a fascinating lecture. And despite his situation and the enormous anger that this blasphemy, as the many Muslims saw it, the blasphemy had provoked in Muslim communities from Bradford to Islamabad, Rushdie's tactful answer was very clear. Is nothing sacred? No, absolutely not, as far as he's concerned. In his view, nothing is inviolable, nothing is absolute or beyond question. No sacred. He described himself as living in the aftermath of the death of God. His own sense of God, he said, had ceased to exist long ago. And he was drawn towards the great creative possibilities offered by surrealism, by modernism and their successors, those philosophies and aesthetics born of the revelation, the realization that, as Karl Marx said, all that is solid melts into air. That's the condition of modernity, Marx said. Everything kind of loses that sort of gravity and solidity because of all the huge changes that have come upon the world in the era of the Industrial Revolution and so on. And so Rushdie's kind of nailing his colours to the mast there. You know, he belongs to that school. That's his condition too. He's part of this condition of modernity. All that is solid melts into air. And he conceded that religions address real needs in people's lives. And he was very generous about all that, actually, when you read the essay. He's not sort of slagging it all off and saying it's rubbish. He's saying, no, religion does address serious questions and concerns, meaning and all that sort of thing. But, you know, and he toyed for a while with the idea that, well, actually, maybe you still need the sacred in some form, and maybe the novel is it. He's a novelist, right? You know, so he's going to... Is everything else sacred? No, but the thing that's important to me, that's sacred. So he toyed with the idea that maybe that you could, in the absence of God, art and the novel might serve to fulfill our God-shaped holes. But finally, he felt compelled to reject even that idea because of his fundamental conviction that to respect the sacred is to be paralyzed by it. To respect the sacred is to be paralyzed by it. Powerful words. As far as Rushdie's concerned, the sacred in any form is conservative, repressive, and the job of the artist is to liberate and renew. I think he's saying a couple of things here in this essay. Firstly, he's saying that the sacred does clearly kind of continue to exist subjectively for some unenlightened people. For as he contends, God is unlike human beings in that he can die, so to speak, in parts. And what he's clearly thinking of there is that, okay, I may not think anything sacred. There's lots of people out there, crazy people maybe, but many millions of people who still live in traditional societies. Maybe they're fundamentalist groups within modern cultures. And for them, the sacred remains a vital force. But essentially, God is dead. The sacred is dying too. Nevertheless, God dies in parts, so it's still around. But secondly, he's saying that the sacred doesn't and shouldn't exist in any objective sense. Rushdie doesn't want the sacred. It's bad news for us. He doesn't believe in it. He can't see how anyone who's truly grasped the significance of our times could either. Is nothing sacred? No, not according to Rushdie. But is he right? Are his assumptions about mainstream Western culture correct? Well, I think, to begin with, Rushdie's own argument ought to give us pause for thought about the continuing role of the religious impulse, even in the mind of a secularized atheistic thinker like himself. He comes very close to making the novel into a sacred object, and only manages to draw back from giving it this privileged status, if in fact he does draw back, by suddenly changing from the language of religion to the language of philosophy. Now, well, we don't need to call it sacred, he says, because, you can't establish a sacred, but we do need to remember that it is necessary. Art and the novel is necessary. But does he succeed in avoiding the sacred by this appeal to necessity? Isn't necessity just another way of speaking about the underlying and unquestionable fundamental forces of the universe, the sacred, in other words? Kind of dodging religious language, but bringing it back in another form, in kind of philosophical language. It's very interesting to me that in the Greek pantheon, the goddess necessity, Ananke, was the mother of the fates. The mother of the decisions that actually rule human lives and govern the universe. And not even the great god Zeus, the father of the gods, could question Ananke's decisions. Necessity kind of underlying everything somewhere or other. So I'm not sure he has actually avoided this business of the sacred. But if Rushdie himself has barely evaded the appeal of the sacred, we ought to be very sceptical of his and all other claims concerning the death of the gods in the modern world. I think that if we approach our own supposedly secular culture honestly, and not just the kind of aberrant fundamentalist groups within it, and maybe we're kind of included in that as well, the crazies as far as Rushdie would say it. But if we look honestly at the culture, what's striking is to me is not the absence of the sacred, but its presence. Once we start looking carefully, we begin to see religious themes, ideas, motifs, symbols, and desires at work in many different places. But they're present in many different forms and under different guises than we've traditionally expected to see them. I first began to think about this when I moved to Atlanta in the 1990s and was bowled over by many things in American culture. It was my first, you know, I mean, just like I'm here in Canada for the first time. My first understanding of America came through the South and Atlanta, and there were all sorts of extraordinary and weird and wonderful things about it, as I was weird and wonderful to them, no doubt. But soon after arriving there, people started telling me I needed to visit this place, the World of Coca-Cola in downtown Atlanta. Actually, it wasn't this one at that time. It was another grand building, like a temple, really, in the middle of the city with, you know, the kind of the capital on the one side and a dirty great church on the other side. And there it was, bang in the middle, the World of Coca-Cola. It's moved to this other prestigious site now and is even bigger and grander than it was before. But people started telling me I needed to go there and I needed to take my kids there. You know, this is a big, you know, a big attraction in Atlanta. So, you know, I was very reluctant, I must say. You know, it costs money and I thought, I'm not taking my kids there. And, you know, this is not going to be their first sort of understanding of American culture. But eventually I decided, you know, purely for the purposes of research, of course, that I'd go myself. And so I forked out the money and I went down to the World of Coca-Cola. Because after all, Atlanta, as the sign at the airport tells you, is the home of the real thing. So I felt this was, you know, the least I could do to identify with my what was now my home city. And it was an extraordinary experience. Because you go in there and you're literally surrounded, embraced by Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola advertising. It's the air you breathe. It's, you know, it's awe-inspiring. It's absolutely imposing upon you everywhere you look. And, you know, above you, beneath you, alongside you, it's amazing stuff. And you really get the sense of, when I said awe-inspiring, I mean, there is something quite awe-inspiring about it, because you realize the extent to which these images and these logos and these slogans are part of your life, and you know them, and they're in there, and they're working, even though when you're not thinking about them. But going in there and just seeing all this stuff, it was quite an overwhelming experience, and you realize, you know, the reach and the power of this product. And it's a kind of history lesson in the development of advertising itself, if you're interested in the kind of business end of things, and how advertising has developed. I mean, you can't really look at advertising, the history of advertising, without looking at Coca-Cola and the important role it's played. And here, you know, this beautiful image, this lovely woman surrounded by roses and stuff like that. But, you know, just the very obvious thing, it's red and white, you know. I mean, that's the reason they're working on these colours and the coding of all that, and the way it impinges upon you and impacts upon your consciousness. She is Coca-Cola. You know, she's not just in the picture with the logo of Coca-Cola. She's there. She's in the world. She's inhabiting it, and she kind of represents it to us. But then you kind of see even more extraordinary extent to which Coca-Cola has kind of impinged upon our popular culture. Santa Claus, Coca-Cola practically, as you see in this exhibition, practically invented Santa Claus. Now, I don't want to, you know, please don't think that I want you to stop believing in Father Christmas, guys. You know, you carry on. But actually, the modern image of Santa Claus was fixed by Coca-Cola. It was an artist called Haddon Sundblom in the 1920s and 30s, I think. And you can see all his drawings there. You can see the images, popular images of Santa Claus before then, and how he was in brown and green and, you know, all sorts of odd assortment of kit. But what Coca-Cola did was to fix him in the popular imagination in red and white. He's walking Coca-Cola, guys. He comes down your chimney, but what's he bringing? Wherever I go, he says, you know, I'm what he, you know, well, he's dispensing goodwill, but he's dispensing Coca-Cola. He's our man. So this kind of image, you realize, yeah, this is quite significant here in terms of popular imagery. And then, you know, you start noticing, you know, the other aspect of advertising as well, the way in which advertising appeals to some pretty powerful instincts. and you know, the kind of sexuality of some of these things from the very earliest days of Coke advertising, and you know, what the associations are between the body of the woman and the bottle of Coca-Cola. And, you know, I mean, you don't have to be a Freudian to kind of to see some pretty interesting forces at work here. That is quite extraordinary. How did they get away with that? I don't know. But that's from the 1950s, I think. And it's maybe it's because it's Spanish, you know. You, what do you expect? But as you go through the place, certainly at that time, you could get the history of the world since the invention of Coca-Cola by standing inside these giant Coke cans. Now, actually, they've taken them away recently, which I'm kind of a bit sad about, really, because there's something bizarre about standing inside a dirty great Coke can, you know, like a bottle of pop, you know, like a fizzy bit of gas. But in these things, you watched these screens and got the history of the world since the 1890s. And you get the idea that Coke has actually been involved in every great movement of the world since that time. You know, the First World War, we were there. You know, the Jazz Age, the Depression, we were there, guys. We were, you know, we were sort of helping people to get through tough times. And sort of see that this is really significant. The Second World War, certainly, and the role it played in kind of keeping the troops happy and fortified and ready to fight for, you know, fight for freedom and democracy. So you really get the sense that Coke is insinuated into everything. There's nothing that's beyond its kind of scope and ken. And, you know, what a magic shot that must have been for them. I wonder how much they paid for that particular shot. Even JFK wants to belong to this world of Coca-Cola too. But because there's a big market and you've got to, you know, keep everybody happy, you've got to, you know, the opposition needs that stuff too. And let's not despise that, because the very interesting thing about Coca-Cola during the Second World War, for example, is that, you know, although it was sending the troops off with cans of with bottles of it, crates of the stuff, and providing it a very cheap rate, or even free in some cases, I think. Coca-Cola was, I think, one of the few American companies that continued to operate in Germany throughout the course of the war. You know, so the aspirations of this corporation, this company, are massive, and they bring in all sorts of stuff that is part of our everyday lives, but. The whole world, you see, wants to be in on this too. It's not just the Americans, it's not just the British, and the English-speaking world, you know, everywhere, Africa, Asia, we want to belong. The advertising that you see in the world of Coca-Cola, the imagery is global. There's a global aspiration, there's a global reach to all this. That is very, very important to the identity of this particular brand. So what you get in this place, the world of Coca-Cola, is a vision of a world united and given life by a brown fizzy drink. And this is Babel reversed. This is humanity restored. It's Pentecost in a can of Coke. And by the end of your trip round the place, you're absolutely gasping for this stuff. You know, you've seen all these adverts and people drinking it on film and you know, boy, you want it. You want this stuff. This is the elixir of life, you know. So when I first started going there, you'd go around the whole exhibition, and then you'd be dispensed the Blessed Sacrament, as it were. You'd stood literally at a kind of altar rail and waited while jets of golden liquid come from the great beyond into your mug as you stand there at the altar rail. And it was truly awe-inspiring. It's changed a bit now. Unfortunately, I've got a bit sad about that, because the kind of Eucharistic elements of it have partly been taken away. But here's me there a couple of years ago, and it's a bit more mundane now, but you still got to imbibe under the great sign of Coca-Cola, the symbol that is within this temple, as it were. It's not quite so awe-inspiring, but there's still a sense of completion, accomplishment, you know, being fed at the end of your tour. Now, the thing that really struck me then about the world of Coca-Cola was the religion. That was what just I just found absolutely gobsmacking. Here we were in the buckle of the Bible Belt, Atlanta, Georgia, you know, all these churches, all this Christianity, and you go inside and it's literally, you know, it's like a temple. I'm not exaggerating here. It's got that sense of kind of devotion and a hushed kind of reverence. And people do go round it with, in fact, when I talked with my students in classes about this, people would get really, you know, emotional talking about their memories of Coca-Cola and, you know, how important a role it played in their lives and so on, and how uncomfortable they felt with me actually making fun of it. So, you know, I don't want to scandalize anybody here, but it was the religiosity of this place. And all those slogans, you know, the pause that refreshes, thirst knows no season. It kind of sounds a bit biblical, doesn't it? Every day of your life, you know, it's there. Every day of your life. Always there over Coca-Cola. It's the real thing. And it all comes together, perhaps, in the most famous Coke commercial of all. And a lot of you here won't know this because you're too young. This is 1971. Very famous Coke commercial called I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke. I'm sure the older ones will remember it because this was in the middle of the Vietnam War. You know, the world was in uproar. The West was in uproar. Students were protesting on the streets. There were riots against war and stuff like this. But here, on this hilltop in Europe somewhere, they gathered together young people from the four corners of the earth. From north, south, east, and west, they came to join in and sing this hymn, this wish for the world. I'd like to buy the world a Coke. And there's something really kind of, you know, it brings a lump to your throat, even as you watch it now and hear these people really with intensity, you know, conviction, singing, I'd like to buy the world and keep it company. I'd like to, you know, I want you to have this. You know, it can draw us together. It can be something that is so, you know, so meaningful in our lives and so unifying. But it's the kids in the film, they sing it with absolute conviction. And there they are holding their sort of bottles before them with hope and love in their hearts. It's like a Barry Manilow concert, you know? Everybody's got their candle in front of them. Or maybe, more disturbing, it's like, you know, pilgrims to Lourdes with their crucifixes. But there they are, holding them out with sort of hope and love in their hearts that this is going to make a difference. And there they are on the top of that hillside. And it's got this biblical thingy again, isn't it? You know, are they waiting for somebody to come back? You know? Has he just gone up? Has he, you know, has Jesus just left the scene? There's that sort of, you know, the imagery of the gathering on top of the hillside, you know, has got certain associations for those of us who schooled in the Bible. But proclaiming the good news, nevertheless, that Coke is it. It's the real thing. And what I came away from the world of Coca-Cola, was a belief that religion isn't accidental to the marketing of this product. It's absolutely central to it. It's not something that's just crept in by accident. There's an intention to this. There's a kind of... advertisers are very smart people. I believe that absolutely firmly. They're well educated in the myths of the world and the great stories of the world and drawing on these things. But I came away with this conviction that the advertising that I saw there was very, very much a kind of religious thing. So I think the important question for us is not, is nothing sacred, or even, is God dead? I mean, those are kind of, you know, the God is dead question is a pretty important one. But actually, in this context, I think the more important question is, what is the nature of the sacred before which we bow? What kind of gods do we serve? Not is there a sacred? You know, what is the nature of the sacred, which is present in our culture? What are the gods before which we bow and we serve? So I want to think a little bit about the meaning of the sacred. What are we talking about here? And I want to draw on the work of a few people in the history of religion, the anthropology of religion. I mean, the biggest name is Eliade, Mircea Eliade, his work, which, you know, although it was done quite some years ago now, still a lot of people read him, and it's a kind of foundational stuff. They might argue with him, but there's a sense in which his work on the sacred and the profane is still resonates today. René Girard is another name who's come more recently to prominence, and Jacques Ellul is somebody that although more peripheral, he's done some really important stuff on the meaning of the sacred too, in books like The New Demons. But for Eliade particularly, but for these others too, the sacred is a power. The sacred is a power. For religious people of all sort of pre-modern societies, and what they're doing is they're building upon a kind of picture of religion, you know, a kind of a religious world before the modern era. So they're looking at, you know, what one might call primal cultures, pre-modern cultures of all kinds, drawing on the artifacts, the mythologies, or even the studies of such groups who are still around in the world today. And the generalization is that for people in these kind of pre-modern societies, the sacred is equivalent to a power. And in the last analysis, to a reality. When we're talking about the sacred, we're talking about the fundamental order of reality. The sacred is saturated with being, with life. And so what people in these kind of societies want to be by being involved with the sacred, they want to be to participate in reality. They want to participate in life. They want to be saturated with power. The sacred is the real thing. And so in a world which is a difficult place, which is a formidable, hostile, human beings feel threatened. They attribute sacred values to that which restores them and puts them in tune with the universe. Gets them in line with the kind of music of the universe, in a way, the kind of the patterns, the rhythms, the reality of the universe. So the desire to live in the sacred is, in fact, equivalent to a desire to take up residence in reality, objective reality, not to be paralyzed by these kind of threats and challenges that life throws up all the time, not to be living in a world where it's meaningless, or all of these things are just one thing after another that are meant to kind of lead you to despair, lead you to kind of think it's not worth it. You want to live in a real and effective world. You want to live in that and in meaning. And that's what the sacred is about. So the sacred establishes a certain kind of relationship with the world. It's a guarantee that the human beings aren't at the mercy of whatever threatens their lives. The sacred is the fundamental order of the world, the order of reality. For René Girard, I'm thinking of a book like Violence and the Sacred here. What threatens human society above all is violence. That's the threat. And that overshadows relationships of all kinds, threatens to break out, engulf everybody, everything at any moment, and smash what we've built so far. It can break out. It can threaten our culture. So the sacred for him is an attempt to address this universal problem of violence, to diffuse it, to deflect it, to disarm it in some way. So religion isn't the cause of violence, as far as as far as Girard is concerned, religion, the sacred, tries to address this threat of violence, which is a fascinating way of looking at things. But for both Eliade and Girard, the institution of the sacred is therefore a defense, a protection. In Eliade's case, against unreality and disorder. In Girard's case, against violence. But there's always a price to pay for this. There's always a price to pay for living in an ordered world. The sacred often calls for sacrifice. So I want to say three things about the way that the sacred works. I think it you know, according to these scholars who've reflected on it very deeply, there's a sense in which the sacred, to begin with, orients us in the world. The sacred orients. It helps people find their bearings in the world. It provides them with a map of space and time. So for the people that, we're in a sacred place when we're looking at these paintings. We're in caves. Actually, this is where these cave art. I mean, these are temples. They are places where people communed with the other world and so on. So these images from rocks and caves and things are just meant to sort of put us into that kind of mentality. But for people in this kind of way of thinking, the sacred orients. The sacred space, sacred place to begin with, is important in this orienting us in the world, giving us a sense of where we are, you know, helping us to find out where we are on the map. Places aren't the same. Space isn't homogeneous. There are interruptions, breaks in it. Some parts of space are qualitatively different from others. So we think of a story in the Old Testament, and Eliade points to this one, Moses and the burning bush. You know, what does God say as he draws, close to this bush? Don't come any closer. You know, the place where you're standing is holy ground. Well, that's the idea. You know, there are certain places, certain kind of certain locations that are charged with the significance of the presence of the sacred. And for people in religious society, the idea is that sense of these. You know, these special locations gives meaning to everywhere else. You have to find your way. You can find your way around the world, which is largely a meaningless world apart from these locations. These are the kind of the focal points. They give meaning to the formless spaces surrounding it. And so it's these spaces that allow the world to be constituted. They reveal the fixed point in the world, the central axis for all. Orientation. Sometimes these breaks are symbolized by an opening. You know, you get the idea of a door, maybe, or a gate, heaven's gate. Those kind of ideas, but or maybe, you know, places where the rock is kind of thin. You know, this location is a thinness here to the other world, but that's it's an opening into somewhere else. And here you get communication with heaven. So you got ideas of ladders, you know, ladders going up to the heavens, and pillars, maybe sacred pillars. A mountain that is sacred because it's high and it gets you to that kind of vantage point. A tree. That is sacred, a vine. And around this axis lies the world, our world. And so this place is the center of the world. It's the navel of the world. This is what gives the world real birth. So sacred place is part of the orientation, and the axis mundi, the center. But also sacred time. Sacred time. Not all, just like all places aren't the same, not all time is the same. And so you've got intervals in time where Ordinary time is interrupted by sacred time, and these are the time of the festivals, the special times of celebration, of kind of recognition of the real in our midst. Maybe these two are the times of sacrifice. This is when it happens. This is when the sacrifices need to be made. And this time is special time because it's kind of reversible. You're always going back to it in some way or another. Ordinary time, it's, you know, kind of going here, there, and everywhere. But in this special time, you're plunging back into the reality of stuff. You know, not the kind of mundane, the ordinary. This is the time of the gods that you're plunging back into, the time that really counts. And so you get reenactment during the stories of the gods, the participation in the stories of the heroes, and so on. And you're integrated into those kind of really important and ever repeated stories and events through ritual and so on. So in this repetition, in this return constantly to what is true, to what is profound, what is actually at the heart of real time, you've got a renewal of the world. And these are often, these are annual events, some of them are kind of more regular than that. But there's this sense of through the rituals, through the participation and the reenactment, you renew the world. And the world recovers its original sort of holiness, sanctity. The sacred discriminates, secondly, the sacred orients, but the sacred discriminates. It's in this process of establishing an order, it tells you what you should aspire to, what you should definitely not aspire to, what you should keep away from. So there's a kind of polarity to this, and it does this through sacred objects and sacred values. But things operate in pairs here, you know. Pure, what's pure, what's impure? What's permitted? What's forbidden? It puts kind of limits on our lives, places boundaries around them. This is to be desired. That's to be shunned. This is to be touched. That can't be touched. Don't do that. So there's an educational dimension to all of this, a moral dimension, if you like, too. This is actually about very much the stuff of your decisions. And what you can do, what you can't do. So it defines a terrain, a domain, in which people are free, and together with a kind of an area which is forbidden to them. They're not free. There's an area. There are things that they're not, places that they're not to go, things they're not to touch, things that they're not to deal with at all. So there's a powerful, a discriminating element to the sacred. And thirdly, the sacred integrates. So it doesn't just give us a map, a sense of finding out where we are in the world and in history and everything, not just discriminating in terms of our values and educating us with respect to what's right and wrong and everything. But this integrates. There's a strong communal dimension to all of this. I love this image of these hands on it. The wall of a cave. This is many thousands of years old. You find these in different places in South America as well as in Europe in cave paintings. And, there's something really amazing about them and much copied as well, I think. But that sense of you're integrated into a powerful community. The sacred exists as a collective. That's what it has to be received and lived in common. And conversely, the sacred has no solidarity unless everyone participates in it to a greater or lesser extent. So the group, the cohesion of the group depends upon this acknowledgement of what is transcendent, what the values are, what the story is, what the thing that binds us all together. You've got sacred people who do this, the shamans and all of that, who kind of kind of facilitate this for the entire group, the ones who've got particular contact, the priests and all of that with the other world, and who draw you into it, but also the sacred stories. They've got a powerful integrative dimension to it. We belong together. This is our story. The sacred binds us together in that sense. So, given this powerful role in ordering reality, I think we have to ask, well, can human beings ever cast off the sacred anyway? I mean, if this is what the sacred has done historically, and we can say is there a sense in which we could ever cast off the sacred? I want to take you now to an exhibition that happened in London about 8 years ago. So I'm afraid it's not there for you to see it anymore, although it has been. It's been subsequently bought by the Tate in Britain. So if you're ever in Liverpool, the Liverpool Tate will have this collection there. This is an exhibition that was showing the work of two young British artists, Jake and Dinos Chapman. And I say it's their work, but actually the press release tells us, connected with this thing, that it's actually their family collection. It's an extraordinary assemblage, says the press release, an extraordinary assemblage of rare ethnographic and tribal fetish objects that subsequent generations of the Chapman family have diligently added to over a period of 70 years. Now, this is kind of common in Victorian Britain, actually. Lots of people who kind of, the imperialists who travelled the world in the name of the British Empire, you know, they collected artefacts from all over the place and quite often had these personal collections. So this is the Chapman family collection of such artefacts. And it's housed in a kind of dimly lit and hushed exhibition hall, just as it might be, you know, in one of those musty ethnographic museums that you find all over the place. There's one in Oxford. Some of you have been to Oxford, the Pitt Rivers Museum. It's, you know, it's packed with these kind of items, and some of them you can barely see because it's so dark in there. But it's got that sort of sense of, you know, there's a kind of reverence surrounding these objects. And again, according to the press release, highlights of the Chapman family collection include virtually unknown primitive trophies and initiation masks from former colonial regions of Camgib, Saif and Ekok, and as such are recognised by accredited experts as being the most noteworthy in the whole world. So this you know, these are not just family collections, these are really significant anthropological finds, so it's good of the Chapman family to kind of put them on show, I think. It consists, the whole thing, of wooden sculptures, each hand-carved and painted in traditional African or oceanic tribal fashion. And we kind of go through it, and, you know, they're exquisite items, beautifully done. And then we sort of hang on, as we go further through this thing, what is that there? There's something just a little bit recognisable about that logo on the one hand, and then that cheesy grin on the face of that tribal mask. That didn't look very authentic. Where was it we said these sculptures are supposed to come from? Well, the joke is, obviously, if you read it backwards. You discover that these objects that are being passed off as kind of ethnographic and tribal objects are actually far from it. Every one of these carvings, statues, masks in there has got somewhere or other a Big Mac reference, a kind of McDonald's logo in it, or something that refers to Ronald McDonald. And it, you know, it's very clever. It's kind of witty. I mean, you know, but of course, it's, you know, it's not that image there. Okay, it's been passed off as a kind of tribal fetish object, but actually, it's very closely related to this kind of animated hamburger that became part of McDonald Land and all these kind of adverts in the 70s and 80s, and some disturbing kind of ways in which the Chapman brothers want to kind of shock us and, you know, force us into thinking about the nature of this product and its icons and the role it plays within our world. And, you know, here's this tribal deity clutching his Coke and fries. So there's a, you know, there's a lot going on in this exhibition. It's playing on Western obsession with so-called primitive art. You know, not only museums and kind of Victorian eccentrics made these collections, but so did many artists too. Like Picasso had a big collection of this kind of this kind of thing. So the Chapman brothers are having a go at that. You know, they're having a go at the sort of the not just about what McDonald's are doing, but also what art has done, how the West has appropriated and kind of the value it's put upon primitive cultures elsewhere in the world. So they're raising questions and about a number of different things, including corporate capitalism and this particular the role of this particular company. The exhibition displays the potency of iconography, so linking the Western fascination with primitive religion to a child's fascination with the McDonald's clown. You know, are they really so different? Are they really? So it's not just making kind of points about kind of religiosity in the West. There's a much broader intent here. But, you know, we have to ask, is this just a kind of leg pull? This is just a big joke on the part of these kind of these chaps, actually, who are sort of enfants terribles of the art establishment in Britain. Well, I mean, I say enfants terribles, they're not enfants terribles at all. You know, their works sell for a lot of money, and when they sold this collection to the Tate, I think it went for a few million. So, you know, is it just a joke? Is it just, you know, just don't take it too seriously, guys. It's all just one big laugh. I think they're making a serious point. Yes, they're targeting globalization. This makes us think about the values of kind of global culture. They're talking about capitalism. They're talking about the prejudices and imperialism of so much Western art. But they're also making a serious point about the way in which the iconography, the strategies of advertising, have a sacred function. If the sacred always involves sacrifice, you wonder, what sacrifices are required by the kind of consumer culture the Chapmans have identified here? What kind of sacrifices have been made in the name of these sacreds? Have there been any made? The environment, maybe, the poor, human dignity and integrity? I want to go back to the question that we started with, which is the question about is nothing sacred? You know, Rushdie was wrong in so many ways about that. And I think it's interesting, since the Satanic Verses thing blew up, a lot of people in Britain are really having to go back and think again about the secularization thesis. I mean, your own Sarah Williams has written about the nature of Christian Britain. You know, is the secularization really all it's cracked up to be? A lot of people are really questioning all these assumptions about the inevitable decline of religion and so on, and with the upsurge of Islam around the world, of Christianity in many places as well, the incredible sort of vibrancy of Christianity in North America, particularly in parts of the USA, these assumptions about the West and religion, and modernity and so on are all being questioned. So I think in many ways, since the whole satanic versus thing has cropped up, Rushdie's been proved wrong in a number of ways. The sacred hasn't been banished from Western culture. And I would say it's more than just the established religions. It's here in these items of popular culture, these things that we do. And I think if you start analysing these functions of the sacred, I'm really interested in sport. I'm addicted to it personally. But I believe that the sport, rugby, soccer, plays a huge role. And you can go through these ways in which the sacred works. Sacred time, sacred place, the shrines of the game, you know, the seasons, the important role that they play in people's lives, the way they integrate people into very powerful communities is a fascinating study to be done, I believe, on websites connected with football clubs in Britain, where you read them. They're way more about football than about football. They're about community. They're about getting advice for your next court appearance. Should I wear a suit? You know, should I wear a tie? This kind of stuff. But there's a sense in which these things are doing so much more. They're integrating people into communities. But the sacred is everywhere, I think, disguised as entertainment sometimes, as consumption, self-fulfillment, but it's there. But I go back to the question that he posed about and the point that he makes about the sacred, because it's really stuck with me. To respect the sacred is to be paralyzed by it. To respect the sacred is to be paralyzed by it. Rushdie's got a point there, hasn't he? This is an iconoclastic essay that he's written, and the exhibition of the Chapman Brothers is an iconoclastic exhibition too. Initially, I reacted against Rushdie's essay by wanting to defend the sacred, by wanting to show you're wrong, Salman. You know, religion's not dead. But Rushdie's real intent is to actually attack the sacred. That's what he's really after. Because to respect the sacred is to be paralyzed by it. So I wonder, what am I trying to defend when I react in that way? What am I trying to read when I say to him, no, it's not that at all, you know? What am I trying to defend? Because the Bible, on almost every page, is also in profound rebellion against the sacred, isn't it? Many of you are serious biblical scholars. I mean, we all kind of need to be as Christians, but a lot of you know a heck of a lot more about this than I do. But, you know, we can't turn the pages, particularly of the Old Testament, without being very much aware of the full frontal attack on the sacred that's taking place. We particularly see it focused in the second commandment, you know, no graven images. A ban on investing things with sacred power, worshipping the creature rather than the creator. We might think that Coca-Cola, McDonald's, you know, these are just a joke, aren't they? They're just, you know, come on, you know, let's get serious about the sacred here. So these products of consumer culture, they're too tawdry, too insubstantial to take seriously. But isn't that the point about the sacred? It's always been thus. The sacred is tawdry. The sacred is insubstantial and pretty useless. The creation myths that were prevalent at the time of the kind of backdrop against so much of which the Old Testament is written, the rituals, the sanctity of the ancient world, they were also ridiculous, tawdry, undignified, insubstantial, absurd. They attack the dignity of God, our Maker, but as at the same time, they also attack the dignity of the human person, the dignity, the integrity of men and women made in the image of God, the people who generate these things. So when the Bible has a ban on images and a ban on idolatry, it's always got two things in its targets. It's always trying to reassert the majesty, the glory of God, and to reassert the glory, the dignity of the human person, because that is what idolatry attacks. It's not just an attack on the place of God. It's also an attack on us who invest these lifeless things with energy, with life, and expect them to do all kinds of things and fulfill all kinds of function. So part of the job of the artist and the writer and the theologian and the Christian disciple, I would say, in our time, is to be iconoclast. We ought to kind of take a leaf out of Salman Rushdie's book, and maybe out of the Chapman brothers too. We need to be creative iconoclasts. We need to be tearing down the sacred while pointing to a more excellent way, creating something that it can be, you know, put. So we're not nihilists. We're not just being negative. We're not just being yaboo. You know, you're kind of going the wrong way. We're actually pointing to something different, something better, something more glorious, more divine, and more human too. And we're all of us involved in this project. I've been a producer for with the BBC for many years, so I've been involved in the business of creating and at times trying to address these things as from my, you know, what was a privileged position as a producer within a public service broadcaster. So I want to show you something that I made. I don't want you to think that I'm showing you to this as any sort of paradigm or anything like that. It's just an attempt to kind of address, as in my own way, some of the questions that we've been thinking about now. And just as a bit of background, this was made for a Good Friday a few years back. It was made with a poet, a guy called Michael Roberts. And it's called "Who Do You Say I Am?" So it's a kind of meditation upon the meaning of Jesus in our times.
People shouted, "Take him away! Take him away! Crucify him!" "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha.
As the stations of the cross make clear, the Good Friday story is a tale of relentless brutality.
Now they order him to carry a rough beam to the top of a hill. Its weight breaks the skin on his neck. There is no cross yet, just the wood across his shoulder and a tree growing on a hill.
He carries the crossbeam that will carry him when it is fastened to that tall tree. What is this tree? Olive? Vine? Twisted holly? Soon it will weigh heavy with strange fruit, the body of its maker. But now it is his burden, and the shadow of its weight falls on those who carry their tired children through dark forests, across rivers and borders, in search of refuge.
The tilt of the cross is on the shoulders of the sick, the lost, and all those who bear this unbearable tree. Unbearable, but not unwearable. Once there was a jeweler famous for her crosses, fashioned from rare crimson gold. She made large ones to hang on chains, diamond studded ones, inscribed ones. They were the must-have jewels.
Then the jeweler heard that crimson gold was running out, She bought up all she could and started making crosses smaller, finer, eking out the last of the precious metal. As the crimson gold dwindled, her prices rose.
After a while, supplies were so short she had to save on gold by missing out the crossbeam. Now a simple vertical, her crosses seemed to say I or one. They kept selling, though they got thinner and thinner.
She was about to retire when her supplier told her they had struck a new vein of crimson gold. She started making big crosses like she used to, with a cross beam, but they didn't sell.
Her market research said the public wanted something different, a new twist on the old shape. The simple cross was so passé. Why don't you put a man on it, they said.
If the cross is still such a powerful symbol in our culture, does that mean the Good Friday story still resonates with us? Or just that we can commercialize absolutely anything?
Okay, so we've got time for some questions, I think, and points and observations, so fire away.
Yeah, I'll help you moderate these questions. We've got microphones at both sides of the back, and since I have a mic, I'm going to start by asking a question, which I hope won't seem like a speech. But
shall I sit down?
No, this has really got me thinking, because one of the definitions of religion that I recall, anyway, is religion is a sacred order within which this world makes sense. And it just struck me that, you know, modernity, modern culture, perhaps because it assumes a kind of, well, the word that we use around here is a univocity of being. In other words, that all things, all being lies on just a flat level and differs only in the sense of the size of the area that it covers, that things cover. And, of course, within that, you know, if you take that view of things, there really isn't any room for God. Now, believers, religious believers have responded by trying to carve out space on this flat plane for God. But, you know, the attempts have been pretty unconvincing and very defensive. I mean, it's a little bit like the reaction to Rushdie's book. But at the same time, it seems like we, you know, maybe the thing we need to remember is that this world on its own simply doesn't make sense. It begs for something like the sacred. And that the secular options that have been forwarded have proven singularly unconvincing. I mean, I think the not only do they not make sense of the world, but they, in particular, they don't make sense of death. And so you take something like Coke, and Coke may well add life, but you can't imagine a slogan like Coke triumphs over death. I mean, it wouldn't work, because nobody would believe it, right? And it occurred to me that perhaps one of the reasons why these sacred themes in popular culture are hidden is not just because they're deceitful or engineered by, you know, advertising people, but because, in a sense, there's a kind of implicit recognition that although they can play to our longing for the sacred, they can't really make sense of this world on their own. And, I mean, the moral of the story, at least as I was thinking about it, is that in trying to defend the sacred, perhaps the one thing that we need most to do as Christians is to defend its sacredness, its otherness. And the very things that we're most inclined to be embarrassed by, like the possibility of revelation or the possibility of the miraculous, the possibility of eternal life. You know, these are all things that we tend in modern times to sort of be embarrassed by. But these are exactly the things the world wants most, that most need to be said. Mm. And I don't know. I wondered what you thought of that.
I mean, I think that so much of what you say is bang on. I think the problem with all of these kind of things is when you look at the stuff of daily life and the kind of expectations that we load on them, they simply can't bear the weight of our expectations. They just they're not up to it, and you know it's ludicrous to expect them to be that way. You know, they're just things. But, you know, Jacques Ellul's got this fantastic line, in the kind of world that we live in, the thing never remains a thing. We've got to invest it with life. We've got to invest it with... Because we kind of feel we're in control of it. You know, we fashion it. When we pour this kind of meaning into... And the problem is we die in the process, don't we? You know, just like the idolater, you know, makes the idol with, you know, the mouth that can't speak and the ears that can't hear and all of that stuff. Those who make them become life like them. We pour that meaning onto this stuff which can't possibly bear the strain of it. And not only do they remain dead, but we become, you know, we die in the process too. So I think this is, you know... But I think to be iconoclastic is actually... no bad thing as far as many of these things are concerned. We instinctively rush to the defense of religion, as it were. What are we defending?
Good, thank you. Okay, other questions? Yes.
First of all, thank you. And thank you especially for mentioning sport in there. It's been something I've been thinking about for a while but haven't quite put words to yet. And thinking not so much of commercialism and consumerism, but thinking of other things, sport being one, I'm just wondering, is the persistence of the sacred within a secular world, is it a sign of hope or is it a reason to despair? Is it inevitably perversion and idolatry, or is it in some ways a reflection, dim though it may be, of truth?
That's an interesting way of putting it. I would just say it's not a sign of hope or a sign of despair. It's actually the human condition. This is the world to which the gospel has always been addressed. You know, and our world is no different to the world of, you know, Moses and David and Jesus. It's the same stuff. The same dynamics are at work. And maybe we just need to be more aware of them and our part in them too. I mean, this is not something that we can point the finger at other people and say, oh, you nasty idolatrous. You know, we're all kind of caught up in this. This is a human dynamic, but I think it's very much the human condition which the gospel addresses.
Thanks for the lecture, and I really want to affirm this idea of coming against idolatry. And I was sort of wondering when you were going to get to the language of idol and the language of idolatry in the place of Yahweh in our culture, and how we can do that. And your image and using images can be a way of doing that, as you've shown. While I am firmly in agreement with you in terms of the prevalence of our advertising culture and brand imaging and the usage of that in religiously, I'm a little concerned about you imbibing that with a sacredness. And the reason for that is because of the very clear, I think you even mentioned it, ability for control. So the powerful controlling the powerless in order to maintain power. And what that implies for previous dispensations of sacredness or other ideas around our world about what the sacred is. So therefore, I'm thinking, well, okay, if advertising or brand imaging is sacred in our culture, and we label that as sacred, then what do we say about Christendom? Is Christendom, its sacredness, sacred because there was a power structure, and the powerful convinced everyone that this sacredness is the world of reality? The image or the paradigm that I would substitute culturally for sacred in terms of a mass, a reality that a culture accepts as a reality in our godless or Yahwehless society at this point would be the paradigm of democracy, liberty, and economic efficiency. These are things that even the powerful subscribe to. Do you have any comment on that? Or could you push back at me in terms of my interpretation of what you're saying about the sacred?
Well, I think that the finger does point back at us and power. And you know, I have no sense in which Christendom is sacred. I mean, I wouldn't want to go into bat for Christendom. I think, you know, we've got major problems. As soon as Constantine brands the cross as something, a sign under which we conquer, that brand imaging of the cross is deeply problematical. Is that what the cross means? In this sign conquer, you know, which then is used in the Crusades and used by the Nazis and still what Muslims fear about the cross, this conquering image. So I think Christians have got major power problems with the sacred and power. And in our structures, so many of our... and, you know, you don't need to point the finger at the Roman Catholic Church either, or the Anglicans. I mean, you see it in evangelical churches where power and, you know, how it's kind of dispersed among a congregation is a big, big issue, the way the pastors kind of wield power. And so, no, I think that power is a central issue for the notion of the sacred, and certainly as far as advertising is concerned, I would think part of its sanctity is this this attraction it's got, this seduction it's got, this way in which it identifies the good life and the powerful life with products. So as far as that sort of analysis of power is concerned, I think we definitely need to go into that as something which is questionable and idolatrous too.
Great. Steve.
I was just struck in your clip how like a symbol like the cross gets quite easily perverted in culture. And then I was reminded of last evening in Christian Imagination, how you talked of the incredible power of symbols within filmmaking and storytelling. And I'm just wondering how you can put these two things together and speak to how we might appropriately use symbols like the cross within church or in Christian life and storytelling.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's a good question. I think anybody who's kind of tried to create things and use... I mean, we're riding a tiger, aren't we? You know, these things have got a life. And, you know, you can't just think, I'm going to take this and I'm going to pour my meaning. I mean, sometimes you hear kind of postmodern claptrap about, you know, Madonna and the cross or whatever, and the way she kind of felt that she could pour whatever meaning she wanted into it and rip it out of historical context. No, you know, there are things, you know, like institutional memory. There's all sorts of ways in which these symbols are working. I think we need to be, as Christians, very careful about how we're using them and how we're kind of manipulating them too. You know, and to get an effect, because that can be really undignified to the person, to me as an artist, to you as an audience, or whatever. You know, where it's not some exploration or something, some evocation of beauty. It's actually something where, again, you're really trying to wield power over people. And you know, I think we've got to be very very, very questioning about that as creative people.
Great. Lauren.
You ended by calling Christians to a kind of iconoclasm, which is an odd place to stop, because and it's been tried before, of course. We could look at certain aspects of the Reformation, where it knocked the heads off images iconoclastically, but more foundationally, the iconoclastic controversy in the eighth century, when the church was really resisting Islam, and iconoclasm seemed to be a good way to go, and after about 100 years of working it out, there came people like St. John of Damascus, who said, there is a place for the icon. And part of the wording of in that great little work is, I don't worship matter, but I worship the creator of matter, who through matter wrought my salvation. And isn't there a sense in which the Christian any Christian who accepts the reality of the incarnation has to affirm the image and the possibility of matter carrying meaning, not because some things are sacred, but because what the incarnation points to is the potentiality of all of creation being sacred, and thus our work being in some ways offering that creation back up to God, and so the challenge is not so much to reject all the icon, to be iconoclast, but to create a culture which is a genuine offering of creation back up in some sense. But
yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you, and I would hate for you to think that by sort of commending iconoclasm to you, I wanted to kind of put myself utterly in that tradition. I mean, I was trying to talk about creative iconoclasm, which I think the Dinos, Jake and Dinos Chapman, kind of achieved something creative by being iconoclastic at the same time. They were through a creative process. They showed us something idolatrous and wrong in our culture. So, absolutely, I believe that there's nothing wrong with the material world. There's nothing wrong with creativity. But I take the point that Rushdie is making about the way the sacred can paralyze us as human beings, and how much of the stuff that surrounds us in daily life is actually paralyzing us, paralyzing our creativity, paralyzing our sense of empowerment as citizens, as people who can change the world, who can, rather than just be consuming this stuff that is there, only for us to consume. So it's a kind of temporal iconoclasm, temporary. And an appeal as well to be creative about it and generous about it at the same time.
Well, thank you very much, Ewan. And please, let's thank Ewan. We've reached the end of our time.